This week on The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
The push to have bigger families and more babies is part of a movement called pronatalism. They are freaking out about declining global fertility rates. And that is real. It's a phenomenon called birth dearth. What's behind this push to start a new baby boom? Who are the voices pushing for a more pro-family America? And what exactly does that mean?
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, streaming now on your favorite podcast app.
As ice melts in the Arctic, more ships are going there, and it is getting more dangerous.
If you think of like one continuous ice sheet, it's very easy to know where it is, where it ends, and it doesn't really move around. But as the ice kind of starts to break up, you have random icebergs or ice flows.
Enter the race to build icebreakers. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, how Finland is edging out the competition. Also, what to make of recent Houthi attacks in the Red Sea.
Basically, the Houthis are back to business.
And the director of a new movie about racial violence in 1970s Rhodesia is not afraid of blowback from audiences today.
I'm not worried. I bring it on. It's so strange to me that it seems to repeat and repeat.
Plus two words, airport music. Coming up today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for tuning in this Thursday. Ice in the northern reaches of the globe is melting. Climate change is warming the Arctic four times faster than the rest of the planet. And now pathways are starting to open up through giant sheets of ice that were previously impassable.
Just this month, the European Union gave Finland more than 90 million euros for a new icebreaker, a ship that can move safely through the remaining ice. Malte Humpert, a fellow at the Arctic Council, says this is part of a frantic race to build more of these ships as countries around the world scramble to expand their icebreaker fleets.
The common wisdom or, you know, the common knowledge or what someone who doesn't really know about the Arctic would think that as the ice melts, it becomes easier to do shipping, and that
right.
is true during some parts of the year. But then you have those shoulder seasons as the ice is kind of breaking up. It becomes a lot more vulnerable to winds and sea currents, and so it actually becomes more hazardous. So, you have random icebergs or ice flows kind of impeding traffic, and then it gets stuck between different passageways or islands, and so icebreakers will continue to be needed even though the ice is melting.
Interesting. Counterintuitive, as you say. There are not that many icebreakers out in the world. How many are there and which countries own them?
There are several hundred, and it always depends on what you define as an icebreaker, because there's pure icebreakers that are really just have one function of opening up a shipping lane, and those would be primarily based in Russia, because Russia historically has had the Northern Sea Route. And then, of course, you have research vessels that have icebreaker quality, so they can break through ice, but it's really not their primary function. They just have the icebreaker capability to get to where they want to go. But there's several hundred in Russia. Russia runs about 40, 50, major icebreakers. The U.S. is pretty far behind. Canada has a significant amount of icebreakers. Finland, because Finland has to keep shipping lanes in the Baltic Seas open during the winter to kind of, get to its ports. And right now we're kind of in that stage where a lot of those existing icebreakers, they're reaching the end of their lifespan. So there's a big push to replace some of those icebreakers and then also expand as there's more need for them.
So icebreakers obviously break ice. I'm wondering if you can break down the components that they have that allow them to do that. I mean, is it just really powerful engines and a big, thick hull?
Yeah, that's part of it. And then also the hull design. And, I have to preface that I'm not an icebreaker designer, but the designs have...
There probably have too many out there in the world.
Yeah, they've changed over the years. And, they don't actually go through the ice. They go often on top of the ice and use the weight to break downward. And icebreakers look a little bit different between on where you want to use them. So a Baltic Sea icebreaker has to deal with different ice conditions compared to an icebreaker that the Russians would use in the Northern Sea Route. or an icebreaker that would operate on the Great Lakes in the U.S. or in Canada. So this one is specifically designed to escort the broader EU infrastructure development, similar to what you would invest or get funding from the EU to build a bridge or a tunnel or a roadway. And in Finland, there are also roadways in the Baltic.
You mentioned this as an infrastructure project, but there are also security concerns here as well. Russia has the largest fleet of icebreakers in the world, as you have mentioned. Is this also something of an arms race?
Yeah, we're definitely in that territory of asking questions about where the normal securitization ends and militarization of the Arctic begins. The Arctic was always held up as Arctic exceptionalism, where we could work cooperatively with Russia in the Arctic Council. It was always Arctic and space were the two realms where there was still really good cooperation with Russia. But of course, all that has kind of changed over the last few years. And as you have more and more economic interests developing in the Arctic, you obviously have security aspects, because you want to keep major investments secure. Similar to the U.S. historically having had an interest in the Middle East, there was a lot of oil coming out of that region. So the U.S. has a lot of military bases and fleets based in the Middle East. And it's similar for Russia. Russia is deriving around 20% of its GDP from above the Arctic Circle. A lot of the large remaining undiscovered and discovered oil and gas resources for Russia are located in the Arctic. And whenever you have those economic interests, then naturally you're seeing, the development of more Coast Guard vessels, the development of more military assets to protect your economic interest. And that's the question where the Arctic is headed. If the Arctic is still a region of peace and cooperation, or is it becoming a more normalized space, similar to like the South China Sea or, the Red Sea, wherever we see maritime conflicts these days?
Malte, I'm still reflecting on what you said about how the Arctic and outer space used to be the two areas where Russia and the West could always cooperate, and the Arctic is no longer. It's just outer space. I think that's something to reflect on.
Yeah, no, absolutely, and the dialogue and the conversation has shifted in the last 15 years, where there was a lot of agreements initially about oil spill response and search and rescue agreements, a fisheries ban. It was really the model of cooperation. Not always easy, but decisions in the Arctic Council had to be unanimous, and we were able to work with Russia pretty cooperatively, especially Norway always had a good connection with Russia, Finland as well. But yeah, all of that has shifted, and the question is, where does the Arctic go from there? Is it too late to kind of you reel it back in and bring it back into a cooperative development model for the Arctic, or is it turning into a race for the riches where environmental considerations go out the window too? And there's a certain irony, right? Like, climate change has allowed access to these oil and gas resources, and now we're exploiting those resources, be it in Russia or in Alaska or in Norway, potentially Canada, Greenland down the road, and that's going to cause even more emissions, which will further accelerate climate change. And so the Arctic in the end is in a way is perpetuating and accelerating its own demise.
That was Malte Humpert talking with me about countries building icebreaker fleets for the Arctic. He is an investigative journalist and a fellow at the Arctic Council.
They're often shiny, they're hard to mine, and they're essential to building high-tech equipment, from electric cars to fighter jets. I'm talking about rare earth metals. Chinese companies dominate the extraction and trade of these metals, but most of the metals don't actually come from China, partly because of what their extraction does to the landscape. The world's Patrick Nguyen has our story.
On a remote mountainside, the machines grind and grind and grind to reach precious metals underneath. That's footage of a huge diesel-powered drill taken secretly by environmentalists. The drill belongs to a Chinese company, but the mountain is in a country next to China, Myanmar, a war-torn part of Myanmar called Kachin, where, as in much of the country, armed minority groups fight against an oppressive military. Now, on top of poverty, airstrikes, scant food and medicine, locals also have to deal with mining operations destroying the landscape.
The destruction is undeniable.
Sang Lee is a researcher from that part of Myanmar. He says for miles around, the mining pollutes streams, making water undrinkable and croplands barren. Here's how it works. Drills punch holes in the mountain. Then workers pour in a nasty chemical, ammonium sulfate, It turns the hard earth into sludge. That sludge is dried, and the resulting ore is stuffed into sacks.
They transport it to China, and then they processing in China, and finally they sell it to the Western market.
One of the main rare earths coming out of Myanmar is called terbium. It looks like silver, but it's 10 times more expensive. With terbium, you can make a magnet that can get really hot, close to 400 degrees Fahrenheit, and not break down. Terbium goes in electric cars and wind turbines. And as the U.S. Energy Secretary Chris Wright recently told Congress, there's only one place to buy it.
China has made a multi-decade strategic decision to own the supply chain for rare earth elements and the magnets that are constructed from them. And they are in amazing amount of devices across our economy.
But forget devices. The U.S. needs terbium for weapons, precision missiles, and radar systems. A whopping 900 pounds of rare earths goes into making an F-35 fighter jet, including terbium. China knows it has the U.S. over a barrel. State-run media says its rare earths dominance, quote, strikes directly at a core soft spot of the U.S. But Beijing has a soft spot, too. Mining rare earths is so environmentally ruinous that China doesn't like to do it at home. Here's Professor Tawei Chu.
The Chinese government already restricts the rare earth mining in China. That's why they need the rare earths in Myanmar.
Based in Thailand with Chiang Mai University, Chu investigates the trade in terbium and other metals. He says mines in Myanmar do give jobs to impoverished locals, but often leave them sick, on top of ravaging the land.
The Chinese usually ignore the environmental and social impact that generate by the mining.
Close to half of China's terbium is actually from Myanmar, but sold as Chinese to the global market. The demand is driving Chinese companies to cut deals with rebellious armed groups in Myanmar. New mines recently opened in areas run by the United Wa State Army, a group described by the U.S. as a powerful criminal syndicate entangled in the methamphetamine trade. The DEA wants to lock up this syndicate's leaders, but the terbium this armed group helps extract could potentially end up in an F-35. Professor Chu says U.S. officials covet these metals, but seldom talk about their true origins.
This is something that a Western country maybe not realize. I'm not really sure.
In Myanmar, more rare earth mines seem to open every month.
More footage of a drilling site in Myanmar. It looks like a scar on the landscape in the midst of jade-colored forests.
Sang Lee, the researcher, says it's tragic. Seeing locals whose ancestors have lived on this land for eons get rashes and lesions from mining contamination.
People are living around the area. They use the waters and they got skin diseases, you know. This frequently happened.
He often thinks about how that terbium will go into the most advanced gadgets and weapons on the planet, while his own people barely have electricity. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen, Bangkok.
Picture for me the British countryside. There's a good chance you just conjured up an image of rolling hills with these nice straight rows of shrubs and trees at the edges of farms and fields. Those iconic lines of plants are called hedgerows, and the UK government wants to plant and restore 45,000 miles of them in the next 25 years. As The World's Hannah Shanatri reports, the urgency behind that effort goes beyond landscaping preferences. It's a local adaptation to a changing climate.
The UK currently has over 400,000 miles of hedgerows. The oldest have been there for nearly three centuries and are remnants of the region's ancient woodlands. But despite their seeming abundance, hedgerows have significantly declined. Will Fitzpatrick works with the advocacy group The Tree Council. He says people started pulling up hedgerows after World War II to make space for bigger farms.
With the Industrial Revolution and the development of new agricultural machinery, we wanted bigger fields to put in more crops and make it more efficient for machinery to move around.
But hedgerows are an important ecosystem and can serve a local role in responding to climate change. Fitzpatrick says restored hedgerows act as a barrier, reducing the rainwater runoff from farms that enters local waterways.
We then see improvements in aquatic biology. We see improvements in water quality. We see soil actually staying on fields rather than getting washed away.
Shoring up that runoff is particularly important as climate change is fueling stronger storms with more rainfall in the UK. Fitzgerald says restoring hedgerows also supports distinct cultural identities. Regional styles have been developed over generations to match the specific agricultural traditions of that area. In the Midlands, for example, hedges are densely laid and bound with willow and hazel to hold in cattle. For The World, I'm Hannah Schnatry.
The Red Sea shipping lanes had been quiet for a few months, but this week attacks on ships have started up again. We'll explain what's going on just ahead. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. In the Red Sea, Houthi rebels are escalating their attacks on commercial ships. On Monday, Houthi rebels used small boats and weaponized drones to strike a Greek-owned cargo ship with a Liberian flag. The rebels kidnapped several crew members before the ship sank.
That was the second of two attacks. Just a day earlier, Houthi fighters sank another Liberian-flagged Greek-owned cargo ship. The 22-member crew abandoned ship, and at least some of the sailors were rescued by a passing vessel. The attacks break a stretch of several months without fighting in the Red Sea. So we wanted to look at what renewed attacks on the global trade meant for the region and the globe. Fatima Abu al-Asrar is a senior policy analyst at the Washington Center for Yemeni Studies. Earlier today, I asked her why she thinks the Houthis, who are backed by Iran, have resumed their attacks.
Iran currently is bleeding. We had that 12-day war, and it has been struck, it has been humiliated. So it's making others bleed. After weakening Hamas, after watching Hezbollah almost get decimated, after seeing Assad weakened and gone to Russia, Tehran basically activated its cheapest and most effective card. So when you see two ships sinking, four sailors dead, basically, the Houthis are back to business. And ultimately, it really has nothing to do with Gaza. So it's really Tehran flexing its muscle and using the Houthis as a way to establish the deterrence that it wants to see in the Red Sea. We've seen these attacks, but we haven't seen this level of belligerence that happened. You know, the explosives on board, the footage. Now, that's new narrative warfare, and there's absolutely a reason for it.
The footage you're talking about is these videos that Houthi rebels meticulously took of the attacks while they were happening and then posted them to social media. Why did they do that? Why do you see that as kind of game-changing here?
We've talked about the Houthis dominating the Red Sea. On some level, we all understand that this is their territory, but there is an impact to the visual aspect of it. This is real terror performance on TV when you see the ship laden with explosive and immediately sinking after these explosions take place. That's the spectacle. So that's what ultimately the Houthis want international shipping companies to understand so that they don't get into the Red Sea. They want the sailors to understand what's at stake. They want a global audience to think that they're doing all of this in solidarity with Palestine and Gaza and that they can put their money where their mouth is. And they're basically establishing dominance over the Red Sea, letting everyone know that this is their territory. Also, if you think about it, the Houthis were ready with new Chinese drones, with radar systems, the whole apparatus. They spent every day since the truce preparing while we debated whether Trump's ceasefire was real. It was definitely an intermission.
So you said that the Houthis are videotaping these acts of violence in order to scare shipping companies. How are shipping companies responding? Has traffic through the Red Sea decreased in the past week?
Oh, my gosh, yes. This is definitely economic warfare as well in the midst, because this is what becomes tangible. We've seen some CEOs of major carriers maintain their Cape of Good Hope routes.
Going around Africa instead of through the cut through between Europe and Asia.
Exactly, because they understand what policymakers seem to miss, that the risk in the Red Sea is not really episodic, it's structural now. You're unable to dislodge the Houthis. So the numbers, as we've seen, there was a 70% reduction in Western shipping, adding like a couple of weeks per voyage, and that's billions in additional costs and insurance. But there's also kind of like a strategic masterstroke, because the Chinese vessels, they're going unmolested. And this is because Beijing has an agreement with the Houthis to have safe passage. And this is a public agreement. Meanwhile, all the Western economies just absorb this inflation. And China here enjoys competitive advantage. So this is basically a reordering of maritime commerce. It's not just chaos and terrorism.
More than $1 trillion in trade passes through the Red Sea every year. You mentioned that traffic is down 70%. I don't know if that was at the height of the violence before the May ceasefire or if that continues to this day. But can you sketch out exactly how much is at stake when there is a disruption there?
You can pretty much bet that no other ship is going to pass through the Red Sea. This shocks also the economies for Egypt. The Suez Canal is very important. And that's gone right now. And I think there's also a humiliating aspect to seeing the United States just abandon European ships. This was a Liberian Greek flagged tanker. So it's like, what kind of responsibility and cooperation is there between the EU and the US? There are multiple vacuums that are happening here at once. It was the EU, to be honest, that lobbied so hard for a ceasefire. And now they're seeing what's happening in the Red Sea. They're seeing even Chinese ships laser their German aircrafts and unable to respond to that. But in the meantime, the axis of resistance continue moving at quicker speeds than our bureaucratic reaction.
That was Fatima Abu al-Asrar speaking to us from the Washington Center for Yemeni Studies. It is a very hot summer for many of us in the Northern Hemisphere. Phoenix saw highs of 108 this week. Here in Boston, not exactly known for its tropical climate, the mercury topped 100 degrees at the end of June.
It's been blazing in Europe, too. Schools in France typically stay open well into the summertime, but closed last week due to excessive heat. Italy imposed a ban on working outdoors for certain hours of the day, and Serbia had its hottest day on record.
It wasn't just uncomfortable, it was deadly. A new rapid attribution study has found that a significant number of the deaths in Europe during last week's heat wave were caused by climate change.
So we looked at 12 European cities.
That's Frederica Otto, a climate scientist at Imperial College London and one of the authors of the study. She says that in all, 2,300 people died.
Of these 2,300, 1,500 have only died because of climate change.
1,500 deaths because of the extra heat caused by burning fossil fuels. If that's not sobering enough, here's another way to think about it.
Out of three deaths, two would not have happened if it wasn't for climate change.
The analysis was conducted by a well-known group that does these kind of quick response studies. They are not peer-reviewed, but the methods used to conduct them are. Methods like comparing today's weather to what the weather would have been like without all the carbon humans have emitted.
Out of the 1,500 deaths attributed to climate change, 1,100 victims were 75 or older.
Older people are more likely to have cardiovascular diseases, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, diabetes, etc.
That's Gary Constantinoudis, a biostatistician at Imperial College London and a co-author of the study. Extreme heat puts stress on the cardiovascular system, he says, putting people with underlying conditions at risk.
This study is the first of its kind to put a number to excess deaths caused by a specific heat event. Previous studies have estimated those figures over longer periods of time.
More global news and stories are still ahead for you this hour. You are listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. A quick look at our top stories today. Ice, specifically Arctic sea ice and the efforts to build more ice-breaking ships. Russia has the largest fleet of around 40 icebreakers. The U.S. has a goal to build a fleet of 8 or 9 of the heavy-duty ships. Malte Humpert is a fellow at the Arctic Institute Center for Circumpolar Security Studies.
Right now, we're kind of in that stage where a lot of those existing icebreakers, be it for research purposes or for security, like Coast Guard icebreakers or commercially operated icebreakers, they're reaching the end of their lifespan. So there's a big push to replace some of those icebreakers and then also expand as there's more need for them.
two recent developments trying to fill that need. The U.S. is putting $9 billion into the Coast Guard's fleet of icebreakers. That was part of the massive appropriation bill signed into law last week. And in Europe, Finland is getting more than $100 million from the European Union to build a new commercial icebreaker, a Baltic Sea Class B icebreaker.
So it's kind of on the upper end. It's not the most powerful, but they're trying to find, you know, the right medium between expenses and also operating cost and the power that is needed.
The new Finnish icebreaker is expected to be in use by 2029 and escorting commercial ships from the EU in the Baltics.
Hopes that a ceasefire deal for Gaza could be reached this week are fading. Israel and Hamas have yet to agree on the terms of a temporary truce and hostage exchange. So the attacks continue. Israeli strikes killed at least 34 Palestinians in Gaza overnight, according to the Associated Press. Israel's military said one soldier was killed in the territory as well. Meanwhile, in the Israeli-occupied West Bank, the world's Matthew Bell reports that tensions between Jewish settlers and Palestinians are getting worse.
A recent video posted on social media appears to show a group of Israeli settlers attacking a Palestinian village outside the West Bank city of Ramallah. Men with their faces covered are setting a car on fire and throwing rocks. News reports about the incident say that Israeli soldiers showed up and found a group of Jewish settlers and Palestinians throwing rocks at each other. In the end, three Palestinians were shot dead. This all took place on June 25th, not far from the town of Taibe, and it's been happening a lot more frequently.
This happening because of the fanatic government in Israel.
Father Bashar Fawadle is a Catholic priest from Taibe.
The fanatic government of Ben Gvir and Smotrich.
These are the far-right members of the Israeli cabinet.
Yeah. It's Israeli cabinet and Israeli ministries who just encourage the settlers to attack the people, to attack and to occupy the land, to put fire in the land, in the houses.
Fawadla's community, with about 1,300 residents, he describes as the only entirely Christian town in the whole region.
Taibe is very famous in the Bible. Jesus was visited. It's very famous for the pilgrimage who come to visit our land, our holy sites in Taibe. And we have a patron of Taibe. So in Taibe, we have patron St. George. We call it in Arabic Al-Khadr. That means the green.
Fawadla says a group of settlers recently started a fire near the ruins of St. George's, and locals were able to put it out. But the United Nations says there's been a sharp rise in settler attacks and forced displacement of Palestinians. Ajit Sungai is head of the UN Human Rights Office in the occupied Palestinian territory. He says the trend is disturbing.
Increase in coordinated attacks by mobs of settlers who torch Palestinian homes, vehicles, lands, and trees, fire live ammunition, steal herds of animals, in addition to daily harassment of Palestinians.
The Israeli military controls the West Bank, which is home to about 3 million Palestinians, along with more than 500,000 Jewish settlers. Ajit Sungai says when it comes to settler violence, the Israeli military is part of the problem.
Not only would the Israeli security forces would be present during these attacks, but in many cases, they're actively participating in them. After 7th of October 2023, thousands of settlers have been drafted in the army. They're soldiers during the day and settlers by the night. We are at a point where it's becoming extremely difficult to separate state and settler violence.
The Israel Defense Forces turned down an interview request, but provided a short response to some questions. It said, any claim that the IDF supports or enables settler violence is false. Rabbi Eric Asherman is an Israeli human rights activist who's worked with Palestinians for decades. He says things really changed after the massacre of October 7th.
You know, in the 30 years I've been doing this, I've never felt marginalized. But I do today, because even people that had some level of support for Palestinians before October 7th just aren't there anymore.
Earlier today, a 22-year-old Israeli man was shot and killed at a West Bank shopping mall by two Palestinian attackers. News reports say both perpetrators were killed on the scene and that Israeli troops soon surrounded a Palestinian village nearby. When you speak with Israeli settlers, they often say that this is the story the news media should be focusing on, not settler violence. Yehudit Taiser is an American-born Israeli living in a West Bank settlement, and she talked with me over the phone.
You've seen this many times. And in my community, a few years ago, a terrorist came in and murdered one of our young girls.
Taser says any Israeli settlers harassing or attacking Palestinians should be arrested and prosecuted. But ultimately, she says what the Israeli government needs to do is annex the occupied West Bank, which religious Jews refer to by the biblical names of Judea and Samaria.
This is the eternal homeland of the Jewish people. It's not going to mean that we're going to do something bad against Christians or Arabs. On the contrary, it's to take back our homeland and to protect it and to protect the name of the Lord and our history.
The Yesha Council, which represents Jewish settlements in the West Bank, issued a statement today. It says the only way to confront, quote, Arab terror is to declare full sovereignty over Judea and Samaria and by carrying out large-scale military operations. For the world, I'm Matthew Bell. A new movie will be in U.S. theaters tomorrow that takes place in a country that no longer exists.
The country we live in was called Rhodesia, but then some Africans said they found it first, and the euro stole from it.
12 whites were murdered with a savage.
But then those Africans turned into terrorists, and that's how the war started. Yeah. I keep a lookout for terrorists.
That's from the trailer for Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. The film is set in the 1970s, told from the perspective of a white child living in Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe, during the war that ended white British rule there. The movie title, like the memoir by Alexandra Fuller that inspired it, draws on a local idiom that means roughly, let's not get ourselves into trouble. The girl in the story is nicknamed Bobo. Her own family is consumed by racism and afraid of losing what they believe is rightfully theirs. Ambeth Davids is the screenwriter and director. She also plays a young protagonist's mother, who's often drunk and sleeps with a submachine gun. Davids grew up in neighboring South Africa and saw parallels between the book and her own childhood. We spoke earlier this week about her movie's perspective on the waning days of colonialism.
Well, the time that I pick up the film, there's a ceasefire on. And I chose to pull this moment and expand this moment and make this the film rather than covering the full memoir, because it just would have been impossible to do in the time that you have to tell a story in a film. But heightened tension, the end of an incredibly brutal war. I'm telling the side of the whites, of the young child and the whites who are filled with terror or filled with the beginnings of the end of the war. But what I don't show is the terrible losses on the black side, the brutality of the war. There are little bits and pieces in the television inserts, but no one's saying really the big behind the scenes was what the losses on the black side were, which were huge and horrific.
So your movie, we're looking at white supremacy basically through the eyes of Alexandra Fuller as a child who goes by Bobo. What does this particular lens reveal about this place on the cusp of independence where the colonial forces are not going down without a fight?
Well, what she did in the memoir, she would go into a narrative of her young self periodically through the book. And this is where this child voice of Bobo emerged. What I did through the lens of the child by making the whole film from Bobo's point of view is I could completely remove any artifice of the adult point of view, and I could give what the child sees and hears and what she parrots. So I think it was sort of my quick shortcut through explaining how a child gets formed by those adults around her. And pure and plain and simply, this is how racism is passed along.
There's this really intense scene where Bobo asks a loaded question of her parents in that sort of innocent way kids do, not realizing what a bomb she's dropping. That exchange is included in the trailer. Let's hear that.
Are we racist?
What? Certainly not.
What sort of people are we then?
I mean, her mom says they're not racist. Do you think she actually believes that, though? Because I think most people who watch her movie would say she's about as racist as it gets.
Oh, she believes it. She believes in her mind, you know, you'll see her later caring for one of the black women that come and ask for medical help. I'm caring for them. I take care of them. But it's in her actions that we read, and in the tone of that voice, she is deeply bigoted and she's deeply connecting herself to the fight, to the death for that land. So the child is watching that, as is the audience.
So, Ambeth, we have to talk about the relationship between the blacks and the whites in this movie. I was struck by the close proximity between black Zimbabweans and the white Rhodesians asserting dominance over them. And with that proximity came this intense fear that you've spoken about. Bobo's parents, they live in constant fear of unseen enemies. What exactly are they afraid of, though?
So the Bush War was characterized by, quote unquote, terrorist attacks on farms specifically. That's where, because it was a Bush War, it was a guerrilla war. The guerrilla terrorists would fight with whatever means they had. And usually the way that they had the most impact was on these stealth attacks on white settlers. And so it crept into the psyche of the whites, who would sit there in their barricaded homes with all their guns ready to take it on. But it was the surprise attacks was how the black side gained their momentum and fought their side of the war. So it's an important part of this underlying terror that sort of begins to creep into the home and certainly is told through Bobo. But there's another side that I try to show as well, which is any blacks that aligned themselves with a white family were also at risk. That's something that happened over and over again. They were co-conspirators. Really, anybody who aligned themselves, even just for a job, was putting themselves at risk if they worked for a white family.
Well, that segues very nicely to the character of Sarah, just a kind of an amazing character. Mm-hmm. There's this moment of the film where Bobo is seen bossing around black kids, essentially mimicking her white parents. And the black workers on the farm discuss this, and ultimately Bobo's nanny Sarah intervenes. Tell us about Sarah, first of all, and the critical perspective she brings to this story.
So Sarah is a compilation of several characters in Alexandra's book. There was a woman by the name of Violet who met a different end, but Sarah became this character. And to me, she's the character that embodies the love. She's the character that embodies the conscience. She's the great truth giver. And this incredible actress, Sikona Bali, just embodied all of that incredible sage wisdom, carrying the weight of the world and yet only spreading light. And she is the one that we think gives the child any hope for a life of normalcy after they leave there.
How do you think Sarah does influence Bobo?
Sarah, in particularly like in the scene that you mentioned, is the only one who says to Bobo, this is not okay behavior. You don't boss the black children around. You are not the boss of them. Or no, you don't smoke, you don't drink. This is the way to look at the world.
We're hearing from M. Beth Davids, the writer and director of the film Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. That's out tomorrow in U.S. theaters. As Davids was preparing for the film's release, a story from her native South Africa was grabbing headlines. White Africana farmers were given asylum in the U.S. I asked her to reflect on the parallels.
Everything comes from what was initially set in place in South Africa. Similarly to Zimbabwe, 1948, a nationalist government was set up, which decided this is the way that we are going to run this country. And anybody who looks backwards through the lens of where history has put us now, everything that exists right now is a result of that. So I'm very open and clear about the fact that if there's any sort of the pendulum swinging the other way, whites in South Africa, very scared, whites possibly facing the loss of something. I just don't buy the white genocide thing. I'm sorry. I've spent a lot of time in the country. I did not see that. I do not see that at all. That's a whole line for who knows what purpose. But I just know that what is inherited is because of what was put in place by the whites. For everybody, for white and black, people inherit what was set in place by that structure.
Have you worried at all that a story from the 1970s might be perceived by some as telling a truth about the present day?
I'm not worried. I bring it on. I embrace it. I go, it's so strange to me that it seems to repeat and repeat. And I heard a certain politician saying something derogatory about African countries. And I feel like when you look at African countries, you have to look at them from the point of view of what they inherited, what was set up, what was given to them, what was handed over to them when things changed. And it was almost a broken system. And so what follows is a result of that. I just always see it through that lens.
There's a sweet moment at the end of the movie that suggests the bridge between black and white, and maybe the bridge between young Bobo, who then grows up into the future Alexandra Fuller, that bridge might be less wide. What message do you hope people take away from the story?
Well, that's the one thing that I did insert. And, you know, I'm here to take the heat for it if it was not in Alexandra's book. But it came from something that Alexandra said about what it was that she took with her from Africa. She now lives in America. What did I, Embeth, take with me from South Africa? It is this one golden thread that sort of connects one to humanity There is just a bigger heart there somehow. And because I do see Alexandra as a survivor of a lot of things in her life, and I do see her roots in Africa as having given her that somehow. And that was the thing that I was trying to show. It is the delicate mirage of a thing that is also real at the same time. And the hope is that then for myself, for her, that we left that continent infused with something that made us better people.
Has Alexandra Fuller seen your movie yet?
She did see the movie and she liked the movie. Her initial response was very, very positive. After the fact, she had one or two notes and said, this shouldn't have been there or that shouldn't have been there, which she's fully entitled to because it's really her story. It's a very precarious thing to try and take on telling somebody else's story, particularly when your own story has so many parallels, because I didn't want to keep butting into her world or appropriating her world, right? But she did like it, and I just am very grateful for that.
That's writer and director Embeth Davids. Her film, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, is in U.S. theaters tomorrow. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Wax museums pride themselves on realistic life-size figures that fool the eye. At the Olavide Museum in Spain, the wax figures are also hard to look at because they're covered in blisters and rashes. Some even have open lesions. What's the point, I hear you ask? The Olavide was started in the 19th century as part of a teaching hospital. Now, this treasure trove of medical history may soon close for good. The World's Jerry Haddon has our story from Madrid.
In the dank basement of the Complutense Medical School's forensics building, Amaya Maruri unlocks a door that leads to a long, dim corridor.
En este vacío se rodan películas.
They sometimes film horror movies down here, the young forensic anthropologist tells me. You don't say, I say. Maybe it's the walls. Hanging from them are dozens of wax models of human bodies and body parts. The skin on each is infected with everything from ringworm to cutaneous tuberculosis to syphilis. We're talking roaring, out-of-control infections from the time before there were cures in the late 1800s. Because of my background, Maruri says, these images don't really shock me. It's the human stories behind them that get to me. Each figure has one, she says. It helps you imagine how they lived and dealt with these illnesses. Maruri takes me into a small annex, shows me a tiny wax figure of a girl curled in the fetal position on a white bed, her naked body carpeted in scaly yellow corpuscles. This is of a girl who worked as a nanny, Maruri says. She was 8 years old. She got infected with a virulent form of ringworm called favus due to poor hygiene and malnutrition. Her precise cause of death is a mystery, she says, but she probably just weakened and succumbed to hunger. The poor thing. Maruri says the little girl's name is kept secret out of respect. She died in 1881 in a hospital that museum director Pablo Lázaro describes as more of a prison than a place to heal. Back then, hospitals were nothing like they are today, he says. They were for paupers. People with money didn't go to them. But prostitutes did. They tended to take up a lot of hospital beds in the late 19th century because at the time, sexually transmitted diseases, especially syphilis, were rampant. If a woman caught an STD, says Lázaro, she was automatically incarcerated in the hospital. And what's worse, he says, if she'd passed the disease on to a client, by law, she was obligated to pay for his treatment. Said treatment back then usually involved applying mercury and salt to the open sores, a practice that Lázaro says likely killed more people than it helped. It's so horribly saddening to know that these diseases, which today can be treated with a simple prescription, would destroy lives, he says. For example, cutaneous tuberculosis would slowly eat people's faces away. Over time, he says, they'd end up looking like monsters and then die. As a teaching tool, Lázaro says, the wax figure's value was more to help students identify diseases rather than cure them. But not all the stories down here, and tragically. Take Teresa, an elderly woman whose wax replica shows a face and torso covered with something doctors in 1880 had never seen. So they named it.
Se la diagnostica como molluscum pendulum generalizado.
They came up with widespread pendulous water warts, says Maruri, because back then they often named things for what they looked like. Today, the condition is known as type 1 neurofibromatosis. It's genetic. In Teresa's medical record, says Maruri, doctors called her affliction the most repulsive thing to behold in a human. How's that for clinical judgment? So repulsive, Maruri says, that all Teresa could do was beg in the streets for money. But her life changed when doctors found her. Despite her disease, Maruri says, or because of it, Teresa confessed to feeling loved and happy because so many physicians studied her. They gave her the attention she never had, she says. It's one of the only happy endings we have. As for the museum's ending, it is imminent, in this location at least. The medical school has given it until the end of August to move out. The school says it needs the space for looking forward, that is, for research. For those who want to look back, they'll need to look somewhere else. So Maruri, Dr. Lázaro, and others are carefully packing the wax figures away in padded, airtight crates. The Olavide Museum has been shown the door before, in fact, about seven times since it was founded over 150 years ago. So Lázaro is confident the museum collection and the unique history it holds will find a new home. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Madrid, Spain.
The visuals might be cringy, but we do have some of them online for you. We're at theworld.org. Just gird yourself and remember, it's only wax.
Experimental musician Brian Eno does not like to fly. In 1977, he was waiting for a plane at an airport in Germany when the incessant sounds of jets landing and taking off and the cheesy pop music coming out of the terminal speakers got him thinking, what should we be hearing?
That's when he came up with the idea for Music for Airports. Brian Eno said in the liner notes that the sound must be as ignorable as it is interesting. Listeners found it soothing and meditative.
This summer, Heathrow Airport in London decided that a sense of calm was something their passengers might appreciate. That led to the idea for a bespoke version of Brian Eno's concept.
The airport partnered with Grammy-nominated producer Jordan Raquet to create Music for Heathrow. On top of ethereal sounds, you hear flight announcements, jet engines, the luggage carousel. A promotional video from Heathrow says the soundtrack lets travelers tune into their trip before the plane even leaves the ground.
See, that sounds to me exactly like what Brian Eno was trying to get away from. Commentators in London are also skeptical, like these guys on Talk TV.
It says it's a four-minute loop created entirely from more than 50 sounds sampled from the airport's terminals and runways. It started playing on Tuesday of this week, and apparently it's going to run till the end of August. I mean, this is where we are in the world.
Someone's laughing all the way.
Somebody at the airport's making fake airport noises to play to people at the airport who can hear real airport noises by being at the airport.
I feel like they could put a bit more effort into making sure that, you know, the power doesn't go down or...
That might be good.
Keeping planes running on time.
In fairness, the sounds are not fake. They're samples of the real thing. Their point stands, though. So, Heathrow, here's some unsolicited advice. Give Brian Eno a call.
And that brings us to our final destination. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We're out of here.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org.
by the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Janae LZ, Vicky and Michael Isip, Genji Kohan, Ashton Peary and Kate Wolf, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.